Hey Weirdos, I'm scheduled for jury duty this week, and well, we never know what's going to be entailed in that kind of thing, so I'm posting some Dark Archives episodes to use until my civic duty is done. This episode is dedicated to anyone who has served on jury duty and forgot to bring something with them to read. Hopefully you can listen to Weird Darkness until the judge calls your name.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
I often felt as though I wasn't alone in that house. From my first night there, I knew there was something wrong with the place. A few weeks after I moved in, I started waking in the middle of the night and found that I was paralyzed. I would be awake for hours without being able to move, speak, or sleep. Then it happened to my sister. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness.
Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. If you're new here, welcome to the show. And if you're listening on the radio or on a streaming station, be sure to subscribe to the podcast too. I upload episodes 7 days a week. And if you're already a member of our weirdo family, please take a moment and invite a friend, family member, or coworker to listen in. Recommending Weird Darkness to others helps make it possible for me to keep doing the show. And while you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com, where you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and more, along with the Weird Darkness Weirdos Facebook group. Coming up in this episode, it's a special Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness, where I reach back into the archives and bring out some dark and strange stories you might not have heard yet, as they are from several years ago. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into this Dark Archives episode of Weird Darkness.
I've lived in the same house in Alaska my whole life. It's a three-story house that is about 30 to 40 years old. Ever since I was a kid, I was constantly terrified in my house. Sometimes when I'm walking up or down my stairs, I get this sudden urge to run. I don't know why. I always feel as though I'm being watched, especially when I'm alone, but even when I'm not alone. My father died of cancer a little over a year ago in the house that I live in, but I have yet to have any signs of him lingering in my house. But my mom said on the one-year anniversary of his death, she woke up to him calling her name. Before he passed, he had said on numerous occasions he would try to open our back door, and it felt as if someone was on the other side of the door, holding the knob in place, preventing him from opening it at first. He said on one occasion he woke up because he felt a shove on his back, and when he woke up in his semi-dark room, he saw a line of different people he had never seen before standing by his bedroom door, and he would blink and they were gone. This happened when he was dying of cancer. Maybe he was delusional, or maybe he was slowly passing on and he was more vulnerable to the paranormal. I have also seen shadows moving along the wall. I have heard footsteps. I have also felt gusts of wind where there shouldn't be any. I do believe this house is haunted, but I have no idea how to prove it. This happened to me when I first moved out of my parents' place into an apartment in an older part of Chicago. I was looking for a job and took whatever I could get. I often felt as though I wasn't alone in that house. From my first night there, I knew there was something wrong with the place. A few weeks after I moved in, I started waking in the middle of the night and found that I was paralyzed. I now know this to be sleep paralysis, but at the time I thought I was going crazy. I would be awake for hours without being able to move, speak, or sleep. All I could feel was a tingling sensation in my body. A few weeks after this started, it stopped. Everything was fine until my sister stayed over one night. She went to bed early and stayed in my bedroom. I stayed on the couch. I slept well, but the following morning, she came out of my bedroom crying. I asked her what had happened, and she told me that she had woken up suddenly and found that she couldn't move, exactly as I explained. But she said a man was standing over her, talking to her in a strange language. She said the man had told her never to return to the apartment again. She was really freaked out and wouldn't stay in my apartment ever again. I thought she was probably exaggerating until a few months after that incident. I was lying on my bed asleep when I was shaken awake by someone. I found myself lying on the bed, paralyzed and couldn't move. It was the same as it had been a few months prior, but this time it was different. A man was sitting on the edge of my bed. In the darkness, I could make out his shape. He just seemed to be an outline, but he was certainly there. I could hear him mumbling away as though in prayer. Suddenly, he turned and faced me, and that's all I remember. Was this a bad dream, or did it happen? Has anyone else been paralyzed by a spirit? I'd like to hear from anyone else who has had a similar experience. I moved out of that apartment after that experience. I've never had anything like it happen since. I still wonder if I dreamed the whole thing. This took place several years ago when I was staying with a friend of mine, Monica, and her family in Maine. Her parents had a summer place out there, and I would go with them quite often. We were in my friend's bedroom when I saw something walk past the window. This is a second-floor bedroom, so I was shocked to see something go past the window. I didn't get much of a look at it, but I know it was completely white, pale even. After that, I tried to tell myself I hadn't seen anything. Monica didn't seem to be bothered by it, so we both spent the afternoon reading and talking together. The next day, we were outside, and I had forgotten about the bedroom incident. We were in the garden when I felt strange, sick to my stomach. I wanted to go inside straight away. Monica wanted to stay outside, but she gave in and we went back to her bedroom. I was looking out the window, and I saw him, a man standing in the garden wearing black with a black hat, looking up at me in the bedroom. He waved at me, and I saw his eyes. They were completely black. After the wave, he lifted the hat off his head and beckoned me to come to him. I stood completely still and did nothing. He stood there for a few seconds, and then just faded away, still smiling. I didn't see him again, but I knew he was bad news. The way he waved at me was creepy. A few years later, I asked Monica about that incident, and she didn't seem to remember anything about it. She said that she had never seen any such man in that area. The neighbors were all families. There were very few older people in the area, so I have no idea who he was or what he wanted. I moved to Connecticut with my family around the time that I had started first grade. Soon after, I began seeing dark figures in my room at night. You couldn't really make out any features other than that they had tall, broad shoulders and wide chests, which made me think they were adult men. None of them had faces. They would pay no attention to me and walk around the room without interfering in anything I was doing. These events didn't happen every night, and the nights they did happen, I sometimes would have some very scary nightmares. At first, this was very frightening, but after I had seen that they would not hurt me, I grew used to them being there. One night was different, though. We had been living in the house for a little over 3 or 4 years, and I just climbed into bed and said goodnight to the figures which had become part of my routine. For the first time, one of them responded and said goodnight back to me. I was very startled from this, but I continued to talk to him. I don't remember the entire conversation, but what I do remember is that he introduced himself and told me that he wasn't there to hurt me. The spirit and I became good friends, and I began to see him during the day. After a couple of years, he and I became so close that I allowed him to actually climb into my body. He had a term for this that I can't remember. After this happened, I stopped seeing the dark figures in my room. I and this spirit would still talk. I would think things, and he would think them back to me. It became an addiction for me to spend time with him. It wasn't until I was about 17 years old that he began to use my body without my permission. Because of this, I got very upset with him and told him to leave my body. And I never saw him again. He just disappeared along with the other figures I used to see. A few months ago, I was antsy to get out of my condo. I decided to go out shopping and tried to lose myself in one of the stores. I'd recently broken up with my boyfriend and I just wanted to be lost and away from any of my problems. As I started to relax and get interested in the clothes I was looking at, I started to feel cold. I had chills and started itching. My whole body felt like one large bite. I felt sick, but tried to ignore it. I was disoriented and I started to lose track of where I was and what I was doing. I decided I should go home. I left the clothes I was going to buy and left the store. In the parking lot, I struggled to find my car. It was very hard for me to move. All I remember is a car going past and standing in the middle of the lot trying to find my car. I think I must have looked like a lunatic. I felt sick to my stomach. My eyes were blurry, but I could see him, an older man in black. He made me feel uneasy. I wanted to cry. I knew I didn't want to be close to him. As I stood there trying not to look at him, I could hear him screaming in my head, loud screaming. That was when I made eye contact with him. His eyes were completely black, and he was smiling. I still felt completely out of it, but he was walking towards me. It took all my effort to move. I remember trying to make a run for my car. That's all I remember. The next thing that happened was a bunch of people standing over me asking if I was okay. I could not comprehend what I had seen. Did I see anything? My mind just wouldn't let me take it in. As I began to catch my breath and calm myself as much as I could, the world around me was no longer black or fuzzy, but finally in focus. I think I met one of the black-eyed people. I have no history of delusion. I've never felt that way before, but I do believe I met one of them. Has anyone else had a similar experience? When I was in high school and was probably around 17, 18 years old, my friends and I were walking down the street in the dark. Now, the street was well lit except for one section where the street light had blown out. We were a little nervous to go through this patch because it just felt eerie. As we reached the dark area, we noticed a white figure next to a mailbox. It was not a white figure. It was an old woman in a white nightgown just standing there staring at us. We figured as we got closer that it would disappear, but it did not. We ran away as fast as we could, even though her house was on the other side of the dark patch, and made someone come and pick us up. Never been through anything like that in my life.
There's more of this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness still to come. Hey Weirdos, check out the Weird Darkness store. If you're proud to be a Weird Darkness Weirdo, you will love the Proud to be a Weirdo design. Grab a classic Proud to be a Weirdo t-shirt, buy some onesies for the newborns in your family or your friends who are new parents. Let them wonder what kind of influence you're trying to be on their up-to-now happy family. Show your office mates that you're even more weird than they thought you were with a Proud to be a Weirdo coffee mug. Bring your laptop to school or work in a Proud to be a Weirdo computer bag so the bullies will stop picking on the nerds and begin picking on you instead. Proud to be a Weirdo phone case will make you look stylish while calling 911 to report being mugged by bullies who wanted your Proud to be a Weirdo computer bag. Get a Proud to be a Weirdo pillow to rest on after being pummeled by all of those nerds who are now mad at you for taking their spot in the hierarchy of coolness and uncoolness. Get a Proud to be a Weirdo tote bag so you can smuggle in a bunch of Proud to be a Weirdo stickers to school or work so you can tell those bullies to stick it. Visit WeirdDarkness.com/store to check out all of the Weird Darkness designs. That's WeirdDarkness.com/store. Weird Darkness and Darren Marlar are not responsible for any physical or psychological violence you may experience from those who say you're weird, but are probably just jealous because you're so dadgum attractive after shopping in the Weird Darkness store. Every month, one email newsletter subscriber is chosen at random to win a Weird Darkness prize pack. You could be my next winner. Sign up for the newsletter for free at WeirdDarkness.com.
When I was a small child in the years following World War II, very few people had or could indeed afford to own a car. The bicycle was the prominent form of transport for most ordinary people, and the ownership of a motorcycle was largely the province of the middle classes. Only the very well-off could enjoy the pleasure and freedom that a car would give as family transport, especially as the rationing of fuel was still in force. You'll then imagine the excitement when our father turned up one weekend with an MG Magnet touring car. The car was in beautiful condition and was painted in two complementary shades of green, a light grassy color above a deep dark racing green. The top of the roof was black, covered with strong, oiled and varnished canvas, and a spare wheel with a luggage rack on the back gave the car a look of purpose. We kids loved the silvery spoked wheels and flowing wings, and its headlights and radiator grille gave the look of a cheery, cheeky face at the front. The car had the unusual feature of the doors opening in different directions, leaving a very big entry space, and the rear seats were higher than the fronts, so we kids always had a good view of the road ahead. Dad had scraped together 50 pounds to buy the car, a good amount in the late 1940s, and we were the only family in the street with our own car. It was in immaculate condition, and although built in the mid-30s, had been little used as the previous owner had perished in the war, and the car had been garaged and unused ever since. Dad had spotted it whilst talking to the owner's father about gardening, the garage being open as they discussed the rose bushes and lawn chatting over the garden gate. After having been given a close look at the car, the previous owner's father told my father that it had belonged to his son when he was at university before the war. The son had been given it as a 21st birthday gift by an uncle who had also promised him a position in his law firm after he had finished at Oxford. Sadly, Britain went to war with Germany before he finished college, and he quickly volunteered to join the RAF, where he trained to become a pilot based in the east of England. The car had been used briefly during his training and then garaged with his parents when he was transferred to a squadron based at Manston in Kent. Within a few months, he was thought to be dead, lost over the English Channel near to Dover, shot down defending the coast as a Battle of Britain pilot. His parents, not being able to drive, the car had remained unused for 8 years, but was carefully kept, as they still hoped their son might turn up as a prisoner of war held in Germany. It was now accepted that he had perished after being shot down over the sea. Our dad was an expert on rose growing, and over a few months the friendship had blossomed. I often went with my father to Mr. Bowen's house, and while the two men attended to the garden together, I enjoyed myself exploring the shed and garage, having biscuits and tea with Mrs. Bowen in their cozy kitchen, or sometimes sitting in the MG pretending to drive. To this day, I can still picture the big hexagonal dials on the dashboard and the quiet clunk as the doors closed. Dad loved the MG too, and the Bowens recognized his enthusiasm. A deal was struck, as Mr. Bowen really wanted our family to have the benefit of the car, especially as my father had given so much of his time to their garden without asking for any payment. To us kids, it was a great surprise when the car was driven home. We had no idea it was coming at all. On the first Saturday, we all cleaned and polished the MG until it gleamed. It really did look very special and posh sitting on the front lawn. Dad had removed the gate posts to get it into the garden, as he was worried about it being left outside on the narrow road. All along the street, neighbors peered from windows or suddenly decided it was a good time to walk to the corner shop. A couple of the bolder chaps actually came to admire the car and give their views on MGs versus other makers, even though neither of them were actually able to drive. Dad had driven during the war, but usually tank transporters and large trucks in the desert, although he had also experienced driving the General in his staff car from time to time. With petrol rationing still being in place, he had to drive the car carefully and without making any unneeded journeys. But as a special treat on our first Sunday of ownership, he and Mom arranged a surprise picnic for us at Bodiam Castle, just over the border in Sussex. The car ran beautifully. Dad had only cleaned a few bits and bobs under the bonnet and checked the tires and brakes, but that was all that was needed. It was almost like driving a new car. It was very new to us, anyway. A year or so went by, and we remained the only family with a car. Sometimes Dad would take Mr. and Mrs. Bowen out, too, if they needed to get anywhere special or to bring large shopping items back to the house. It was on one of these journeys that the mystery started. Mrs. Bowen could only travel in the front of the car, as she quickly became travel sick if seated in the back. Early one morning, Dad had picked them up to take them a few miles to visit an elderly relative. As they made their way along the A-259 Coast Road towards the seaside town of Folkestone, Mr. Bowen suddenly asked my father to stop and turn off the engine. The old chap sat in the back of the MG, listening very intently and with tears streaming from his eyes. He kept repeating softly, "At 10 o'clock, at 10 o'clock," and rocking gently back and forth. My father climbed out from the driving seat and opened the door, asking Mr. Bowen what was the trouble. It seemed that as they drove along the road, a great feeling of fear had come over the old man. He had suddenly felt very cold and felt something lightly pressing on his shoulder as a weak but recognizable voice intoned, "At 10 o'clock," over and again in his ear. He described the sound as being very electrical and faint, like a badly tuned radio broadcast. My father wondered if he had maybe fallen asleep for a short while and started to dream, but the old gentleman insisted that he had not. They carried on with the journey, nothing more happening, and the incident was quickly forgotten and not talked about again. Several weeks later, we went out as a family, a day out to the beach at Dymchurch, a small coastal village on the same coast road and to the west of Dover. As a family treat, it was a great success. We even had a cream tea and ice cream, a real luxury in the hard days following the war. The effects of the conflict were still apparent in the area, including the old concrete listening posts on the hillside overlooking the French coast. France was just 20 miles away across the channel. The barbed wire fences were also still in position in places along the beach. There were much more important things to do than remove the wire. British people were struggling to survive still, and essential work was being performed in other areas of life. We rambled about Dymchurch in the afternoon, relishing the sunshine and freedom of movement which had been denied for 6 years and by the time we returned to the Green MG, all of us kids and Mom were completely tired out. We traveled back through the country lanes, only rejoining the coastal road as the sun made its way below the horizon across the sea, a blaze of gold against the darkening skies. I became sleepily aware of a cold pressure against my leg, and without waking completely, told Toby to stop playing around. My young brother was always a fidget, and I was very sleepy. As I started to doze again, a tiny voice seemed to whisper into my ear. "It's coming from 10 o'clock," it said. Just that, no more. But it terrified me. I suddenly awoke completely, and it was as though a bright orange light was bearing down on me very fast as I opened my eyes. I froze completely and could not move, a feeling of great danger and fear taking me over completely, and I screamed out loud. Dad swerved to the side of the road and quickly comforted both me and Toby, who, frightened by my sudden scream, had burst into tears. Mom and Dad thought that I had fallen asleep and woken in the middle of a nightmare, and joked with me about having had a tiring day at the seaside. We had stopped close to a small roadside cafe, so more ice cream and fizzy drinks calmed us down before we went on our way home. We never had any trouble from the MG, which we had all christened as a family Maggie. Dad was very keen on checking everything out on the car every Sunday, topping up the water, dipping the oil, a job which I often did myself as it felt like being a real mechanic. Mom never learned to drive properly, but she did often have a go in the car. She was okay driving in a field or open space, but was very scared of driving with other traffic. Looking back, there was actually very little traffic in those days compared to the snarled-up roads today. One of the real pleasures of the car was receiving the friendly wave from other MG owners as we met them on the road. It was like an impromptu club, and we really felt that we belonged to something special. One summer afternoon, we had stopped at a country pub and were sitting outside, enjoying lemonade, when another MG drove in. This one looked very sporty, as it was bright red and cream and was open-topped with just two seats and a wicker picnic basket fixed to the back. The driver parked alongside ours and within seconds was chatting to Dad about the cars. He actually recognized our car. It turned out that he had known young Mr. Bowen quite well when they were students together and had fond memories of the car too, as they'd often taken girls out together in it to summer parties before the war. In fact, it had been the reason that he had almost bought an MG, although his one was a sporty PB midget. It looked far more exciting to me, as it sat there without a roof and two tiny windscreens, just like a real racing car. During the afternoon, he took my father for a short ride, and they quickly became friends, as folks do with a common interest. His name was Rupert, and before many months had passed, we were calling him Uncle Bear, after the Rupert Bear stories in Dad's newspaper. He told us many tales of his time at Oxford with David, our car's previous owner, and how they had toured down to the West Country together in the spring of 1939 when the seeds of war were growing in Europe. David had been passionate about doing something to help if push came to shove and war really started, and hoped to be joining the Air Force if possible, Rupert told us. We would sometimes all go out together, two lovely MGs and their passengers, heading out for a picnic, perhaps, or a day at the local races at Folkestone and stopping on the way back for tea in one of the villages. Dad was now working near Rye, a lovely ancient town which had originally been a famous coastal port until the sea had receded. Rye was now a couple of miles away from the coast, but was served by a tidal river and still had a full fishing fleet sailing from the quay. The drive to Rye is a lovely run along the coast from Hythe, following the edge of the Romney Marsh, and cutting over the tracks of the famous Romney, Hythe and Dymchurch Railway, the world's smallest public train service, which serves the market towns and villages along the way. He would sometimes stop to photograph the lovely engines, each one a small, exact model of its full-size counterpart. The trains had run throughout the war, carrying supplies and also being armed with anti-aircraft and anti-tank guns to fight off the threatened invasion if it ever came. On one of these trips to Rye, driving along the coast road on a fine summer morning, Dad had felt the presence of somebody or something close to him in the car. Of course, and as you know, in England, cars are driven on the left of the road, and the driver sits on the right side of the car away from the hedge or pavement. He had this strange feeling of being accompanied for a good part of the journey, but put it down to the noise of the tires on the road, reflected back through the open window. Then, passing round a sharp curve, he was suddenly blinded by the full, low morning sunshine projected directly into his eyes. At the very same moment, he heard the words said loudly in his ear, "It's coming from the sun directly at 10 o'clock. Dad felt the steering wheel being physically turned sharply to the right, and the car immediately speed up, and then hitting the curb on the right side of the road before coming to a fast, skidding stop in the open entrance to a farm drive. Feeling the shock, he looked behind and across the road to see a large and solid petrol tanker truck with steamy water pouring from its radiator and at the exact spot where he had heard the warning voice. Shaken, he got out of the MG and ran across to the truck. The truck driver was already out of his cab and sitting on the step with his head in his hands. "Are you all right?" asked Father. "What happened?" The driver looked up and kept repeating, "I am so sorry, I am so sorry," in a shocked voice. "I'm so sorry, I could have killed you. My brakes failed as I approached the bend, and the lorry would not turn in fast enough to go around the curve. I thought I was going to kill you. How did you see me in time to swerve?" Dad put his hand on the driver's shoulder to comfort him. "I did not see you at all," he said. "The sun was blazing directly into my eyes as I went around the curve. But I was warned, and somebody, or maybe something, seemed to take control of the car from me. He told me quite plainly, 'It's coming from 10 o'clock. Then it steered me out of danger. "Is your car damaged?" asked the driver. "And I hope you're not hurt either. This could have been so much worse." It seemed that no damage had been done to the car at all, but the lorry had knocked down several fence posts, which had damaged the radiator and lights, and had also burst a tire. They were both glad that nothing worse had happened. Dad took the driver into Rye, where he could find a telephone, report the damage, and arranged to get the lorry moved. He still felt shaken, and after calling into work, was promptly sent back home to recover. A few days later, Rupert came to see us all, bringing a new girlfriend, a young lady who had been an aircraft tracker at Manston during the war. Dad, of course, told the story of the near crash, and Grace listened very intently to the story. As Dad finished the tale, she looked away, with tears in her eyes. "I must tell you," she said. "At 10 o'clock is a term used by flyers to show the position of aircraft in the sky, seen from the point of view of the pilot and using a clock face as reference. It seems to me that a pilot was warning you of the impending crash, indicating that the impact would be coming from in front of you and to the mid-left-hand side. Whatever, someone took avoiding action and saved your life that day." Rupert had listened closely to all of this, and his face had gone pale. Quietly, he said, "David. David was looking over you, and the MG too. He really loved that car and must be so pleased that you're taking care of it for him. David's spirit was taking care of you." There seemed to be no other plausible explanation, and our family has thanked the spirit of David the Airman ever since that day. We all now believe in ghostly intervention. We kept the car in the family for many years. It was revered by all of us, and it gave us much pleasure to be keeping it as David would have wanted. It passed through the family from person to person, kept spick and span, and was finally retired by us to Rupert as a gift, as we felt that he was the closest person to David. The car still exists, and I have since seen it looking smart and well cared for at vintage car shows across England. Many years later, it still retains the MG number plate that it was originally registered with, and the headlights twinkle, and the grille still grins like a happy face, but which also has deeply secret knowledge. The mystery of the Gurning Man of Glasgow, who vanished into thin air, has never been solved. Was he a madman? An illusion? A visitor from another time or perhaps a parallel universe? Whoever he was, he certainly did strike fear into everyone who had the misfortune of encountering him. The first sightings of the Gurning Man took place in the late 1970s. Most of the encounters with this odd being took place in Glasgow, Scotland, around the district of Crosshill, usually between 4 and 9 p.m. Suddenly, women started to report seeing a figure shaped like a human, but behaving as if he was insane. The sighting took place for 3 years, and many of the women were so traumatized that they left the area, moving to an entirely different place as far away as possible. One woman in her 50s, who lived with her husband and children, woke up in the middle of the night. She saw a something sitting at the end of the bed. It looked like a man who grinned at her in the most maniacal fashion while bizarrely rubbing his hands fast up and down his chest. She yelled and woke her husband, who looked everywhere, but the creature had vanished into thin air. The sighting could have been easily dismissed as a nightmare, but it was just one of many reports coming from women who had no knowledge of each other. Just some days before the woman observed the Gurning Man, two teenage girls had an equally horrifying encounter with chilling similarities, which they alleged took place less than 100 meters from the other witness's home. While walking home from a party, they noticed a strange man who they described as being aged in his late 50s, bald, extremely thin, and dressed in a tight black leotard. He was stood beneath a streetlight and appeared to be nervously moving on the spot with agitated actions. As the two girls approached the man, their sense of fear grew, and they stopped talking so as to concentrate on moving past the odd figure as quickly as possible. As they passed, they could see from their peripheral vision that the man was pulling a bizarre, contorted expression, halfway between a smile and a pained grimace. The girls became nervous and frightened and started walking faster to get away from the man. One of them looked back to see if the odd man was following them, but was astonished to see that he had vanished from sight entirely. It was as if he had vanished into thin air. Then there were more reports. In total, there were 17 reports of the Gurning Man made in the Crosshill area of Glasgow between 1976 and 1979. 11 of the sightings were made on the street, whilst the 6 other sightings were reported to have occurred inside someone's home. All witnesses reported seeing a man in his 50s. He was bald, very thin, and dressed in black. His movements were jittery, as though he were incredibly agitated. He was able to vanish into air within seconds. The mystery of the Gurning Man of Glasgow has never been solved. Who was he? Was he just a work of imagination, or was he a real person? Was he mentally ill or maybe homeless? Some think he might have been a time traveler, or perhaps a visitor from a parallel universe who accidentally entered our visible world. Whoever he was, he is still remembered, and his name still evokes terror in Glasgow.
Keep listening. There's more of this special Darkhives episode of Weird Darkness on the way. Hey, Weirdos! Weird Darkness has been nominated for a podcast award in 4 categories this year: Storyteller Drama, Society and Culture, True Crime, and the coveted People's Choice category. You can vote for Weird Darkness in all 4 categories at the same time by visiting podcastawards.com. Once you sign up to vote, you'll find all 4 categories in the left-hand column. People's Choice at the very top, and then bottom left-hand column for the remaining 3 when you scroll down. While it's still on your mind right now, please, go vote! Only you, my weirdo family, can help Weird Darkness become an award-winning podcast this year. Go to podcastawards.com and vote for Weird Darkness in the Storyteller Drama category, the Society and Culture category, the True Crime category, and the People's Choice category. And thank you, weirdo family, for nominating and voting for Weird Darkness. The following is a creepypasta that does have some severe language. I've decided to leave it in order to honor the author's intent. Listener discretion is advised.
December 15th, 1985. Joram Bernstein. Well, time surely does fly. It's already been 40 years since my wonderful stay in Auschwitz. To my surprise, I'm not horribly tormented by the memories of that putrid hellhole of a prison like most people I have come to know during the time. Well, at least not anymore. Probably because, in my perspective, it's best to forget. Well, not exactly forget, so to say, but rather to just make the best of everything with the life I still have. It'll never be the same again, but at the very least, I still have one. I mean, for Christ's sake, I stared right into the malevolent eyes of death itself with calm but cherishing smiles. When you're faced with an army of Nazi soldiers guarding the camp, pointing MP40s at you with bullets with your name on it, you tend to try to remain calm, do as you're told, and hope for the best. To my surprise, it worked. Although I don't know what worked more, the fact that I always remained calm or whatever monstrosity that intervened that some claimed to be a rogue angel. After the war ended, I moved to the U.S., hoping to get my mind off of this whole experience. A typical man's life. Story short, I was happily married, had two kids, Ellie and Jonathan, and then a divorce. Lost custody, and now have a whole house to myself while I drown in alcohol. Hell, if you thought what happened during the war traumatized me, well, allow me to be straightforward, it didn't. Why? Well, it's quite simple. I never had any attachment to any of my fellow prisoners. I was kept to myself, followed the guards' instructions, and never allowed any emotional connection with anyone. I know that sounds really callous, but during the time, you had to keep yourself numb and pray to God that you'd survive. As cold as this sounds, I had nothing to lose. Every man for himself, I guess. As I drank a glass of scotch that I have longed for since the time of day, I received a call from someone I wasn't familiar with. As I finished the last bit of my drink, I answered, "Hello, Mr. Bernstein?" asked the unknown caller. "Who is this?" "My name is Daniel. I just need to ask you something." I did not have the energy to ask how he got my number or how he knew my name, so I complied. "All right," I said in a tired, irritated voice. "Listen, I'm working on a book about survivors like you, and I was wondering..." I vaguely interrupted him as I knew what this was about. "Let me guess, you want an interview with me about my story during the Holocaust, am I correct?"
"Why, yes, sir, if that's okay for me to ask."
I sighed heavily, rubbing my eyes from bitter annoyance, and told him my address. "Go ahead and come in tonight."
"Are you sure?" he asked.
"I have nothing else to do. Go ahead." I hung up. I could tell he was an anxious young man who aspired to get my story out there. This isn't the first time I've been asked for an interview, and it's certainly not going to be the last. Over the years, I never complied with anyone. Not that I was uncomfortable, but there was just nothing to tell. I learned to burn those memories away and to simply move on from whatever hells I've witnessed. Besides, whatever I have to say, he probably has heard it before, so why not just get this interview over with? About 2 hours later, he arrived on my doorstep. I let him in without him knocking. He took his hat off and politely said, "Hello, Mr. Bernstein, I'm Daniel Adams. Pleased to meet you." He held his hand out for a handshake. "Likewise," I replied. I welcomed him into my home and led him into my office. He was dressed quite nicely, I should add. He had an obvious smile on his face, as if this was his first interview for his new book. His smile faded away instantly when he noticed my personal library. He began to shake a little when he hesitantly asked me, "So you're studying demonology, the occult?"
I turned around and embarrassingly chuckled. Yes, just personal research. Behind my dusty desk sat a massive crimson shelf filled with books, journals, and documents about the occult and the nature of the paranormal. On the wall beside the shelf was pinned a little old sketch of a blurry monster I made several years ago. He nervously smiled as he pulled out his pen and paper. "I apologize if this makes you uncomfortable," I said. "We can go in another room if you like."
"Oh, no judgment here," he replied as he scratched his head, nervously smiling. "It's just a little unexpected to see that many books about demonology in one room."
Before I could speak, he stared down to the ground like he was ashamed.
"I'm sorry, I shouldn't have asked."
I leaned towards him and said, "I'm normally not a patient man, but you're young and I have a lot to learn, so I'll let that slide." He looked up at me and revealed that nervous smile once again, ready to write. I asked, "So, what do you want to know?"
"How did you feel during the time?"
Again, his eyes lingered upon the ground, ashamed of his question. I gently placed my hand on his shoulders. "Son, it's okay. What happened was a long time ago. Feel free to ask me any question you like, okay?" He looked upwards with a distant smile, regaining focus. "All right, to answer your question, I didn't know what to feel." I cleared my throat. "To tell you the truth, I was numb the entire time I was there."
"The horrible things the Germans did didn't affect you?"
he asked in a voice more concerned than confused. "At first they did. Mostly when I was in the departure train on the way there."
"What was that like?"
"It was treacherous. There were at least 30 of us in one car for 5 days. Very little rations and water. No bathroom, not even a little porthole-sized window to look through. Almost complete darkness every day and night. It was during the winter as well, and with the little clothing I had on, I hardly slept at night. During the day, I say I got an hour total because the rest of the hopeless prisoners moaned in disbelief that we were here. I heard a few choke out as their lives slowly faded away from dehydration. I always hid in the corner with my knees tucked against my chest, hearing all these haunting wails screaming for death to come and take us all. I remained silent as I drifted into the corner. I think that was the first time I cried as well." I took a deep breath after I spoke. Mistaking my tone for discomfort, Daniel asked me,
"Are you okay, Mr. Bernstein?"
"Yeah, I'm okay. I just need a drink." I cleared my throat again. "Anyways, it was horrifying, but the only reason why I'm still alive is because I always kept to myself. If a guard gave me an order, well, if you were smart, you did what he said, or you would be shot, or worse."
Daniel was puzzled. "What do you mean, worse?"
I poured another glass of scotch before I spoke. "You see, the Nazis were ruthless. When you're in the camp as a prisoner, they could not give two shits about you. To them, you're a waste of skin. God's mistake, made for disposal. They completely disregard the fact that you're a human being. It didn't matter who you are, whether you're white, black, or any other color in the rainbow, male or female, or even a child, unless you're proven to be a good use for manual labor, they'd kill you in any way they pleased." As Daniel wrote everything I stated, he began to shake.
"Wait, even children?"
he said in a really faint tone. I took another drink from my glass. "Yes, I've seen toddlers and even newborns thrown into pits of fire. Oh my God, their screams. See, this is where I started to become numb from the whole thing. Even after the mothers witnessed their children burning into a crisp, they'd shoot them and burn their corpses in the same pits just because they could. I can still hear their screams in my sleep." As I filled another glass, I said, "I'm sorry, it's one of those few things that really haunt me, even to this day." Daniel put down his pen and paper anxiously.
"Oh my God, I'm sorry. We can stop now if you want."
"No, it's okay. I needed to talk about that. I just need a moment. I took a deep breath and regained my train of thought. All right, where was I? Oh yeah, that was only the beginning. It was like the first circle of hell itself. Worse was yet to come, and even after being emotionally numb, I still wasn't ready. During my whole experience, for my 4 years of imprisonment, I'd say I spoke maybe a total of 10 words. When they gave me orders, I did exactly that. Most of the time, it was a struggle, but I did what I could to stay alive. With the very little rations and water we were given, I nearly strained myself until dawn, but I was still alive. They specifically chose me to handle certain tasks as they did with anyone else they saw fit. I wasn't holding my breath, however. They could shoot you for target practice at any time, even while you were working at any time. In most cases, they'd gather a large group, only to be placed in gas chambers. Oh my God, the screams again. Even behind closed doors, you could still hear their screams as they suffocated to death. Daniel began to get angry. Those sick bastards, how could they do that? He gripped his pen tightly. Because they could. And because they could, I almost died. I was selected for execution because my time was up. I was against a wall with rotting corpses surrounding me. I thought their reeking flesh was the last thing I'd ever smell. The terrified faces of my fellow prisoners. The sinister smiles on the guards' faces. I thought that would be the last thing I'd see. They fired, killing everyone except me. Somehow, I was still alive. Not a single bullet hit me. I kept my eyes closed and held my breath and pretended I was dead. As awful as this sounds, I could feel blood smothering me. I used it to my advantage. Oh, God. This was when I almost truly died. I would much rather have been shot, but since they thought I was dead, they were about to dispose of my body in the pit of fire. Daniel suddenly stopped writing and looked at me confused. Wait, you said you were still alive because you kept to yourself, right? Right. And you're saying they almost executed you and burned you alive, right? Well, if that was the case, how did you escape? You're giving me two different stories. Ah, shit, I thought to myself. This kid pays attention. I guess I gave myself away on that one, huh? He got his pen and paper ready once again. What really happened? How are you still alive? I hesitated for a brief moment. I'm gonna need another drink for this. As I poured my last glass, I could feel his anxiety. He knows there's something I left out on purpose. He knows there is a truth that I didn't intend to tell. Well, he will know why my truth was hidden. Look, what I'm about to tell you is completely true, and I do not plan on going to a mental institution. He looked at me as if I was delusional. What do you mean by that? So, obviously, you see all those occult books here, right? You'll soon come to the realization as to why I do, but you have to swear to me that you'll believe every word I say, okay? I'm not crazy. Daniel appeared afraid. This is the part of my story that really fucked me up, and I have a good reason why I never talked about it with anyone. You're the only one I'll ever tell this to. I sighed. Ask any survivor of Auschwitz, and they will all give you the same reaction, same expression, and same fear. They are all too terrified to tell the tale. So, Daniel, I know how this sounds, but you have to believe me, all right? He nodded yes while he began to shake. I could see a speck of sweat on his forehead. So what happened? All right, here goes. I took a deep breath. So there was this one prisoner who we all talked about during our time. We didn't know his name or his number for sure, but I believe it was Bruce. He was a really vengeful character,
Rumor had it that he was somehow possessed or something. He occasionally attacked the guards, but the funny thing was that they wouldn't kill him on the spot. I saw him rip out someone's throat in front of an officer, and all they did was pin him down. I saw him rip out a piece of someone's rib cage and shoved it down his throat with brute force. I saw him take a man's gun and empty a clip into his face. Man, he was one strong, angry bastard. Daniel stopped me. Wait, he killed a few guards? That would be an understatement. He brutally mutilated them.
Well, if that was the case, why didn't they kill him, especially if he was a threat to them?
I don't know. It's like they were expecting it, testing him somehow. I heard one officer say, "Perfect." Even to this day, I wish they had somehow killed him. I finished my drink. Daniel grew even more anxious. One day, he charged up to a guard, tackled him to the ground, and brutally beat him until his head was battered. That's when they finally decided to execute him. After four murders, they finally decided enough was enough, which was quite odd. I know it sounds strange and abnormal, but there was something about him they found fascinating. It took five guards to restrain him. An officer smiled and shot him in the heart. Even after that, he was still somehow alive. They dragged him to a flaming pit and tossed him in. I hesitated to tell him the rest.
"And what happened after that?" he asked.
I stared at him for at least a minute before speaking. "Look, I really don't like talking about this." I took another deep breath. "So, before they almost threw my body into the pit, I heard shouting and women's screams. It was so grotesque. They dropped everything they were doing, including me. As I lay there pretending to be dead with my eyes barely open, I could see five guards restraining the violent prisoner. His face was covered in blood, and he had an eager smile as the officer approached him. I could hear what they were saying. The officer said, 'What a waste. You were so perfect. But it looks like you're no different. False hope for a flawless creation, only to fail like all the rest. No matter, there'll always be others of your kind.' The prisoner gave a sinister laugh and replied, 'When I get out of here, I'll find you, dismember your flesh piece by piece, and feed it to your battered face while your family watches.' He then spat blood in his face. The officer punched him and shot him point blank in the heart. 'Toss him into the pit,' he said." I took a deep breath yet again. Daniel was nervous, but very intrigued.
"So what else happened?"
I sat there for a moment before I finished my story. They completely forgot I was lying there, so I stood up and hid behind a building. I know that was very reckless and would have gotten me killed for sure, but what happened next? Oh, dear God. I paused before continuing on. As they threw his body into the pit, I could hear him screaming. Such agonizing pain. But there was something peculiar about him. The more he screamed, the more distorted it became. Each scream was an octave lower than the last, and the volume progressed until it came to the point where it was monstrous and unbearable to hear. And suddenly, it stopped. It was like he absorbed the flames, and he let out a demonic screech, gushing blood, which looked like a fountain of crimson. Oh, my God. He didn't appear human anymore. His eyes illuminated pure white. His arms were covered in scales, to best describe it. They were as black as night, with fang-like spikes that glowed blood red, with claws that took on the same color and shape. He had large, angelic wings that looked mystic. The wings were there, but it's like they made the illusion of mist, black fire. I can't even describe it. The next thing I knew, he attacked the surrounding guards swiftly. In quick moves, he butchered right through their flesh. I know this sounds crazy, but I saw him forge a giant scythe out of their blood.
It was like he defied the laws of physics and somehow made a solid, sharp weapon. Demonic magic, to best describe it. More guards came after him, and he took incredibly long and fast steps towards them and slashed right through them. At one point, when a guard was in a pool of blood trying to run from the creature, the prisoner somehow created a thick spike that rose from the ground, impaling him from his anus out of his mouth. I don't know what he was doing, but it was like he could manipulate blood in any way he wanted, like he could control it at will. Clearly, their weapons were useless against him as he forged the scythe into a spiraling longsword. Can you just imagine the dread they felt as the last thing they saw were those glowing, malevolent eyes with that demonic laugh mocking their pain as he slaughtered them like helpless animals? It was literally a bloodbath. He brutally mutilated at least 15 guards before flying away. The oddest thing, he specifically targeted the Nazi guards. No prisoner was hurt, not even a scratch on those who were nearby. It was like he unleashed all of his personal hell only to hunt down and murder those that caused his pain. Daniel was baffled and shook with fear. So he just turned into some kind of monster and killed all those people? He stared at me like I was a madman. I know how it sounds, but it's the truth. What he did to those guards truly traumatized me. I see, Daniel said softly. He closed his book, and he asked me one last question. So how did you escape? After the creature fled, the rest of the guards panicked and ran away as well. They burned all evidence of our documents, their whereabouts, and left us for dead. It was the Americans that discovered the camp, and of course, they came to our aid. Daniel continued to look at me in disbelief. I'm sorry, Mr. Bernstein. I don't know. Are you sure you know what you saw? I became furious with his question. In anger, I replied, Listen, kid, you don't know what it was like down there. You don't know what it was like to watch little children burn right in front of your eyes. I've seen the Nazis pile bodies in a truck only to bury them in a trench. I raised my tone. I know what I saw. I have devoted my life to find out what the creature was. That's why my family left me. That's why my kids were scared shitless. They thought I was mad. They thought I was as crazy as my stories when I got all those books trying to find out what the fuck this thing is. Ask any other survivor or any other Bernstein that could tell the same story. They are too fucking terrified to tell the truth. So before you start calling me crazy, you might want to be a little more understanding on what I have fucking witnessed. Do you understand me? Okay, I understand. I got the chance to calm down as I sat on my chair. I poured myself another glass and softly said, Look, I'm sorry I screamed at you. I know this doesn't make any logical sense, but I know what I saw, and it was real. It really screwed me up, but I am not crazy. Daniel calmed down as well. It's okay, I understand. He politely asked, Did you ever find out what this creature was? No, I couldn't find anything that even closely resembled what I witnessed. Whatever it is, however, I have no doubt that it's still out there, and it's hungry. Daniel grew nervous once more. Mr. Bernstein, I have a confession to make. My grandfather was a Nazi soldier, but I strongly disagree with his actions and his views, and that's why I'm writing this book. But this monster, you said he specifically targeted men like him. If I'm related, does that mean I'm next? Well, I highly doubt he'll try to hunt you down for that reason, but just in case he confronts you, just don't tell him about your grandfather. From what I've seen, he doesn't kill innocent people. Just don't piss him off. And above all, whatever happens, do not bleed. Daniel had enough and gathered his gear and walked out the door. Thank you for your time, Mr. Bernstein. I must be going now. Have a good night. All I did in response was lift my glass and softly said, "Cheers." I knew he was terrified, but at least he listened to my story. I know what you're thinking. How could this be real? The textbooks would have described this. Oh, please. Those damn history books never reveal secrets that weren't meant to be told to the world. However, that's the problem. Nobody knows who this creature was. Where did he come from, or why he was there? All I know is that he's angry, inexplicably powerful, and kills any Nazi that crosses his path. With that motivation, I still remain unsure whether he was a brute vigilante or just a beast lusting for blood. As a storm approached, it began to rain unnaturally hard. Seeing my old sketch of the figure I had made a long time ago, hoping I would find anything like it, I approached it with a smile while finishing my drink. As I stared right into those hypnotic white eyes, I asked myself, "What the fuck are you?"
Thanks for listening to this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. And if you've not done so already, be sure to subscribe to the podcast. I upload episodes 7 days a week. If you want to reach out to me, you can email me anytime with your questions or comments at Darren@WeirdDarkness.com. That's D-A-R-R-E-N. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Minds, MeWe, and you can join the Weirdos Facebook group on the Contact Social page at WeirdDarkness.com. While on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, click on Tell Your Story to email it to me. Or tell your story by phone by calling the Dark Line toll-free at 1-877-277-5944. That's 1-877-277-5944. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find source links or links to the authors in the show notes. Weird Darkness is a production of Marler House Productions. Copyright Weird Darkness 2021. I'm Darren Marler. Thanks for joining me in this special Dark Hives episode of Weird Darkness. Congratulations to Renee Hardy. She is my winner for July in my newsletter's monthly random drawing. Renee wins an extra-large Weird Darkness poster, 2 coffee mugs, 2 magnets, and 2 stickers. Maybe you could be my winner for next month. Sign up for the Weird Darkness newsletter at WeirdDarkness.com and you're automatically entered to win. And again, congratulations, Renee!